we don't have Russian experts anymore. That's one of the fundamental problems, is that we don't have legitimate Russian experts. Ray McGovern was a Soviet expert. When Ray McGovern worked at the CIA, he knew the Soviet Union inside and out because that was his job, and he gave solid assessments based upon facts. And they weren't assessments designed to please people. They were assessments designed to inform people. You know, when I was involved in this stuff, the guys I worked with, the guys and gals I worked with, these were the smartest people in the world about the Soviet Union, about Russia. They knew the culture. They knew the history. And more importantly, they knew the people. They studied the people. They met the people. They talked to the people. Jack Matlock is one of the most superb ambassadors the United States has ever had. And he was the second to last ambassador in the Soviet Union. He left right before the August 1991 coup. But the man is brilliant. We don't train people like this anymore. George Connell, Doug England, Roland LaJoy, these are the foreign area officers that advised presidents, advised senators, advised everybody about the military capabilities of the Russians and the Soviets. We don't have these people anymore. You're not allowed to think like this anymore. You have to follow dogma and doctrine. My daughter just graduated from Georgetown University in the master's program at the Foreign Institute. All right, this is it. This is the one that they train all the State Department people on. And they cookie cutter people. They don't want you to think. They cookie cut. It's a cookie cutting process that produces clones, whose job is to fit into a system that doesn't want you to think certain things and think outside the box. But it's not just that. They don't know what they're talking about. The people today that are advising the president, advising anybody, have no knowledge of Russia. I learned more traveling to Russia twice in the last year than they've learned studying their PhDs. They've written PhDs about the autocratic dictatorial nature of Vladimir Putin, the most evil man on the planet. All you have to do is write a PhD about that, and you will get, man, they'll pass you. But God forbid you come in and say Vladimir Putin is, one of the most, amazing, transformative leaders in the modern world. He took Russia from a horrible situation, brought it up here. Let's look at his leadership style and how he operated. Oh, they don't want to know that. So these people don't know any. The people in NATO, they don't know Russia. They don't know the Russian leaders. They don't know the Russian leadership. And so they make these politicized assessments from not from fact, but from emotion. They are desperate. They are losing. Ukraine is losing. They need continued American financing, material support, political support, American political support to hold Europe together, because you pull American political support, Europe falls apart literally overnight. And the Europeans know this, so they can't let America withdraw, but the fear is that Trump is going to unplug. So this is an existential issue for them. So they have come together, and the terms they use are, we are Trump-proofing NATO, we are Trump-proofing Ukraine, to ensure that Trump can't unplug. And the only way you can Trump-proof is to take us up to the brink of nuclear war. And that's what they're doing, either wittingly or unwittingly. That's what they're doing. There's many of the people, again, because these are politicized assessments, that they don't believe there's going to be a nuclear war. So they don't understand the consequences, or they've not allowed themselves to think of the consequences. But the reality is, again, Dmytro Polyansky, the deputy Russian ambassador to the United Nations, is a very, very smart man. I've met him. I've talked to him. And he says this is the most dangerous situation that has existed in the nuclear era, that we are closer to nuclear war today than at any time, that the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the point that I made and he concurs, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had diplomatic interaction taking place. Kennedy could talk to Khrushchev and was talking to Khrushchev indirectly. We had ambassadors talking, ambassadors visiting. We had ambassadors meeting. We had back channels. We were communicating, and that saved us. That communication created opportunities that then led to solutions to very difficult problems. I don't know how many Americans know this, but Anatoly Antonov, one of the most qualified ambassadors Russia's ever had to the United States, a genuine expert on the United States of America, and the man who negotiated the New START Treaty, so he's an arms control expert, left. He's gone back to Russia. they haven't replaced him. Now, they have a deputy ambassador. I think I've met him. He's a very capable man. But my point is that the ambassador is not here. Why? Because for 7 years he was here and nobody talked to him. For 7 years he was here and nobody talked to him. And the Russians have just given up. We don't talk to the Russians. When was the last time Tony Blinken picked up the phone and called Sergei Lavrov? I don't think it ever happened. The point, Jake Sullivan's not talking to his counterpart. We have William Burns talking to his counterpart, but that's, you know, intelligence to intelligence. We're not communicating at a time when we have to communicate. Now is the time for communication. But you can't communicate unless you're programmed to accept, to at least listen to what the other side said. We refuse to listen. We refuse to listen. We don't want to hear. We want to dictate. We want to lecture, but we don't want to listen. Therefore, there is no communication. And that means we're not going to find a way out of this when the time comes. And that's why this is the most dangerous period. We are moving closely to the point. Look, the Russians have already said, and I'll leave it with this. Vladimir Putin laid out a new nuclear doctrine. And I read it and I went, well, hell, that's already been violated. And Peskov said the same thing. You've already crossed our red line. If we wanted to legally, we could use nuclear weapons against you. But we're showing restraint. And that scared me because I'm like, wait a minute. Guys, you understand that you've already crossed the red line. Doctrinally, Russia could use nuclear weapons against us. And they don't care. They see Russian restraint as Russian weakness. So they're going to double down and keep pushing and pushing and pushing until the Russians say, we can't yield anymore. That's why they fired the Oreshnik missile, because they couldn't yield anymore. But at some point in time, they'll have to fire the Oreshnik with nuclear weapons because they can't yield anymore. And as Annie Jacobson said with Ted Postol's outstanding advice, 72 minutes after that first nuclear warhead goes off, it's all over. We all die. It's it. That's where we're at right now. This is crazy. Okay, let's say we survive up until January 20th and Donald Trump comes in. He is operating under the premise that he can pick up the phone or he can send somebody or something and get the Russians to respond in a radical, dramatic fashion to his imperative, to his initiative. And that shows an absolute ignorance about not only how Russia works, but the influences on Russia. You know, the last time Russia underwent, had a leader that did radical policy changes without adequately consulting with the system. Russia's Soviet Union is a very big place. Things don't happen that quick. It is like a giant ship. It gets momentum. It moves, and to change the trajectory, you have to begin to make inputs in to make it move. Gorbachev destroyed the Soviet Union, destroyed in terms of the military economy and then the rest of the economy, because he implemented unilateral decisions into a system that wasn't prepared to act on it. He injected decisions about stopping production. You know, when I was at Vodkinsk, and I didn't have perfect knowledge of it then, but I have pretty good knowledge of how it works now. And you don't have a city that is literally a factory town where everything is linked to the factory. So the factory pays the salaries, the factory builds the schools, the factory stocks the stores, the factory does the cultural events. Everything's paid by the factory, which means you have this delicate economic balance taking place that the factory manager has to, factor in ballistic missile production, not what we're just doing now, but what we're going to be doing in the future. We have to have contracts out there. We have to make sure we have the people trained for this. We have to have the machine tools ready to do all this stuff. It's very complicated, and it takes a lot of lead time. And if you're going to make an adjustment, you have to give them time to adjust accordingly, or else you get collapse. And Gorbachev came in, signed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which got rid of, in the case of Vodkinsk, SS-20 production, SS-12 production, SS-23 production, and then what people don't realize is it also got rid of the Skorost missile, the Courier small ICBM. It gutted. I mean, it took out five major systems, all of which were needed to keep the economy going, and left it with, you know, the SS-25 and some follow-on. Not enough work to keep the factory going, not enough. Then when he changed the he went to cost accounting, Kozor Schultz, I think it was called, in 1990, that means that you went away from state planning. You had to make money and pay your salary based on what you made. The factory couldn't pay anybody because they weren't making any money because the Soviet Union canceled all the missile contracts. They had no money to pay anybody, and everything starts to collapse. Now imagine you do that across the country, and you understand what happened when Gorbachev implemented perestroika. He destroyed the country. And then Yeltsin came in and was trying to recover from the disaster of the collapse of the Soviet economy and the Soviet policy. Putin today has rebuilt Russia in a manner that never again allows those mistakes to be made. The way Putin has built Russia today is based upon Vladimir Putin traveling to oblast, meeting with governors, having conversations with governors, taking that conversation back to committees who review what the governor said, advise the president, who comes back to the governor, and it's a collective decision that, and the governor, meanwhile, is meeting with his people. And the bottom line is everybody's on the same page. The system is functioning. You're not going to come in and tell Vladimir Putin, I need you to change everything to appease me so that I can get the political result I want in Ukraine. Isn't going to happen. So anybody that expects the Russians are going to, A, do something to appease Putin, Trump, or B, would even consider it. And this is where Trump needs experts. This is where Trump needs people who know Russia and explain to him that what you're doing is doomed to fail. And that's the problem. Trump will not succeed in his Russian policy because Russia will not self-destruct to appease Trump. If Trump understood Russia, understood what would be needed to get the changes he wants, and had diplomats in place who were doing the preparatory work, but it will take months, if not years, of concerted, informed diplomacy capable of making compromises to work out the situation where the Russians might be willing to do something for Trump. But then the Russians have to ask themselves, what happens after Trump? He's a four-year president. Who comes after that? What are the guarantees that things we begin with Trump, because you're not going to finish it. You're not going to finish any meaningful arms control treaties. You're not going to finish anything meaningful at all. Is J.D. Vance going to be the president? Do they have confidence in J.D. Vance? So the Russians aren't in the business of making these radical moves. Russia is going to be the ship moving with this steady momentum, and that's the reality that America has to adjust to, and I don't think Trump can, and I'm concerned what happens when a Sebastian Gorka tells Donald Trump, just tell Putin you'll double down on weapons shipments. That if Putin doesn't do what you want, you're just going to open the floodgates and pour weapons into Ukraine. And then they may look back and say, yeah, and that includes longer range systems. We'll give you a standoff missile so you can strike Russia deeper. And Trump will go, okay, because he has a national security advisor who's inclined to think like that, a secretary of state who's inclined to think like that, a secretary of defense who's inclined to think like that. The only sane voice might be Tulsi Gabbard, who says, hey, excuse me, Mr. President, that might lead to thermonuclear war tomorrow. but again, Tulsi has to be backed up with Russian experts. There's no Russian experts in the system. None. And Tulsi's not a Russian expert. And so I'm really concerned that this president's going to get bad advice and act on improper political impetus, misread the Russians, and we're going to war. I did a meme. I don't normally do memes, but I've become attuned to the internet. In the lead up to the election, where I just basically fed off of the Avengers movie, Infinity Wars and Endgame, but 1 in 14 million chance to save the world. That was Iron Man's thing with Doctor Strange. So I did a meme, and it was, you said we had, one in 14 million chance to save America. Is this it? And then in the end, Iron Man, when he snaps his finger, instead of saying, I am Iron Man, he says, I am voting for Donald Trump. But that means it's a 1 in 14 million chance that voting for Trump doesn't guarantee any outcome. In fact, the outcome is likely that we're going to have a nuclear war because Donald Trump is advised by bad people and he's picked bad people and they don't know Russia. There's a 1 in 14 million chance, but Putin's not going to sit there and change everything he does for that 1 in 14 million.